Wow, good morning. My little pointer. Yes, excellent. Okay. So, Job number three. What I'll say today, I have leaned heavily on the work of wisdom of other people who have written wise words and so on. And so I've built on that, but I'm still responsible for whatever's said this morning. So Job is a righteous man. He's lost everything. He's lost his family, except for his wife. He's lost his wealth. He's lost his health. And he's lost his dignity. Nothing gives him pleasure anymore. Nothing at all. Can you imagine that? That nothing gives you pleasure. That is pretty low, really. So it's not surprising that in his first speech in chapter 3, he wishes he'd never been born or that he'd died at birth. And this has all come about, it would seem, because a celestial being called the Challenger suggested that Job only served God for what he could get out of it, that he was in the game for the blessings, so to speak. But God stuck up for Job and disagreed with the Challenger. And as we saw in the earlier messages, Job lost everything. So now we wait and see whether Job is going to walk away from fearing and serving God. And in the second message, we heard from Job's friend Eliphaz. And that was just the beginning. There's between Job and his three friends, there's another 14 speeches. The friends say something, Job responds, someone else speaks, Job responds. And nothing much constructive happens. They just seem to get more convinced by their own arguments. Job's friends treat Job worse and worse, and Job just gets angrier with God. In Job chapter 30, verses 20 to 23, Job says this: "I shout for help, God, and get nothing, no answer. I stand to face you in protest, and you give me a blank stare. You've turned into my tormentor. You slapped me around, knocked me about. You raised me up when I was riding high, and then you dropped me and I crashed. I know you're determined to kill me, to put me 6 feet under." Right, whoopsie, that didn't work. We're there. So today, the rest of the book of Job, and look especially at God's policies and how God runs the world. So this is where I finished 3 weeks ago with this triangle diagram, which brought together three themes that push against each other. It seems that God's justice, Job's righteousness, and the retribution principle cannot all be true at the same time. So Job's friends are committed to the retribution principle, which says that God blesses the righteous and punishes the wicked. And the corollary, what follows if that's true, is that if things go well for you, it's because you're righteous, and if things go bad for you, it's because you're wicked. Bildad's first speech in chapter 8 states this really clearly. This is what he says, just verses 1 to 3 and verse 20. "How can you keep on talking like this? You're talking nonsense and noisy nonsense at that. Does God mess up? Does God Almighty ever get things backward? It's plain that your children sinned against him. Otherwise, why would God have punished them? There's no way that God will reject a good person, and there's no way he'll help a bad one." So there's Bildad's pretty clear view on how things worked. But what's interesting, at least to me, is that Job is also committed to the retribution principle. So in chapter 1, verses 4 and 5, we were told that his sons used to take turns hosting parties in their homes, always inviting their sisters to join them. When the parties were over, Job would get up early in the morning and sacrifice a burnt offering for each of his children, thinking maybe one of them sinned by defying God inwardly. So why did he do that? Because he feared that if his children had done wrong, God would punish them. So he's kind of signed up for the retribution principle as well. His view is that God is just, and a just God who operates according to the retribution principle would never make the righteous suffer. So Job wants to take his case to court, to God's court, have a proper hearing, and receive justice. I'll read a bit from chapter 9 and chapter 10. Job says, God and I are not equals. I can't bring a case against him. We'll never enter a courtroom as peers. I wish I had an arbitrator to step in and let me get on with life, to break God's death grip on me, to free me from this terror so I could breathe again. Then I'd speak up and state my case boldly. As things stand, there's no way I can do it. Here's what I want to say. Don't God bring in a verdict of guilty without letting me know the charges you're bringing? You know good and well I'm not guilty. You also know that no one can help me. So Job's three friends and Job are committed to the retribution principle. And then there's the God's justice part of the triangle. Job's friends believe that God is just. And one example of this is what Abraham said in his conversation with God about the destruction of Sodom. This is in Genesis 18:25. Abraham says to God, far be it from you to do such a thing, to kill the righteous with the wicked, treating the righteous and the wicked alike. Far be it from you. Will not the judge of all the earth do what is right? So there's only one conclusion for Job's friends. If God is just and the retribution principle is true, then Job can't be righteous. Job has done something wrong and that's why he's suffering. But Job doesn't see it that way. He's on board with the retribution principle. He's certain he's done nothing wrong to deserve this suffering. So Job starts to question God's justice. And that's why he wants to take the case to court, to get justice. So we actually have two accusations. The first one is the accusation of the challenger way back in chapter 1, where the challenger said, it's bad policy for righteous people to prosper, because that compromises their motivation for being righteous. So like people might do the right things, but they're doing it for the wrong reasons. So that was the accusation of the challenger, saying that it's not a good policy, because people do it for what they can get out of it. But now Job is making an accusation as well. His accusation is it's bad policy for righteous people to suffer, because that's inconsistent with God's character and justice. So this is why he wants to have a court hearing, so that his case can be heard, because God does not punish the righteous. So that's it. Job's got nothing more to say. He's done. Done. God has not responded. His three friends have done their very best to convince Job that he needs to confess his wrongdoing to God. God's appealed for a hearing, and it seems that he hasn't been heard. So that's where we are. Now, there's that big picture I showed a few weeks ago. All the stuff that's in yellow we've done, and now we're up to the purple bit where I've got a few more things to happen. We've got Elihu to come in and do some talking, and then God's got something to say, and then it gets wrapped up. So Elihu appears on the scene. He's listened to all the arguments, which kind of raises the possibility that a whole lot of people may have been listening to this conversation. Don't know, but could have been the case. Now, Elihu has lots to say, six chapters worth. And even though he supports the retribution principle, he brings quite a bit of wisdom to the conversation. And I came to the study of Job thinking he was just another friend who'd missed the mark and misunderstood God, but he actually deserves more respect than that because he has brought a more God-focused and less simple explanation of why things work the way they do. So let's look at what he says. Just got one slide on that. Elihu is not happy with Job's position and his view of God. So reading from Job chapter 33, verses 12 to 14. Let me tell you, Job, you're wrong, dead wrong. God is far greater than any human. So how dare you haul him into court and then complain that he won't answer your charges? God always answers one way or another, even when people don't recognize his presence. So the first thing that Elihu does is he defends God's justice, which was the part of the triangle that Job was questioning. In Job 37:23, Elihu says, "Mighty God, far beyond our reach, unsurpassable in power and justice, it's unthinkable that he'd treat anyone unfairly." Then Elihu talks about the retribution principle, but he disagrees with Job's friends because he sees that he thinks that they're guilty of counseling Job to bribe God. In other words, Job's friends encourage God to repent of things he didn't do in order to get back all the things that he'd lost. And it seemed to Elihu that they were trying to bribe, counseling him to bribe God. Now, Elihu goes a bit further and enlarges the scope of the retribution principle and suggests that suffering now might help us to avoid sins in the future. So he says that the retribution principle can be preventative as well as remedial. So it can prevent things as well as being punishment or blessing after the fact. Now, it took me ages to get my head around that. So if that just went straight over your head, just forget about it. It doesn't really matter that much. Next thing, Elihu does not question Job's righteousness like his friends did. He accuses Job of being self-righteous by demanding a court hearing from God instead of just trusting that God's ways are good. Here's what Elihu says in Job 34. "All right-thinking people say, and the wise who have listened to me agree, Job is an ignoramus. He talks utter nonsense. Job, you need to be pushed to the wall and called to account for wickedly talking to God the way you have. You've compounded your original sin by rebelling against God's discipline, defiantly shaking your fist at God and piling up indictments against the Holy One." And then, finally, Elihu makes it very clear that while God does not need us, we need him. He makes it clear that God is not accountable to us, but we are accountable to him. To be fair, our sin does grieve God, and God does delight in our righteousness, but that doesn't mean that God's well-being depends on our behavior. The French writer Voltaire said this. He was no fan of the Christian faith, but he wrote, "If God made us in his image, we have returned him the favor." Now, one of the lessons from the book of Job is don't do that. Don't recreate God in your image. God is God and we aren't. It's not necessarily true to think that he thinks like we do. So I'll touch on that a bit later. Okay, so finally, God speaks. He asks Job a lot of questions. He asks Job 77 questions, to be exact. It's not really what you'd expect in terms of an answer. So firstly, in chapter 38, God asks Job questions about whether he understands, whether he comprehends God's creation. So verses 1 to 5. And now, finally, God answered Job from the eye of a violent storm. He said, "Why do you confuse the issue? Why do you talk without knowing what you're talking about? Pull yourself together, Job. Up on your feet. Stand tall. I have some questions for you and I want some straight answers. Where were you when I made the earth? Tell me, since you know so much. Who decided on its size? Certainly you'll know that. Who came up with the blueprints and measurements?" And on it goes. So that's the first bunch of questions. The second bunch of questions that God has for Job is about caring for God's creation. What do you know about the wild donkeys, the ostriches, the hawks, the horses, just to name some of the created animals that God mentions? And then a final lot of questions about whether Job can control creation. And in this section, God speaks about the land beast called Behemoth and the sea beast called Leviathan. A lot of ink has been spilt on exactly who these beasts might be. Maybe Behemoth's the hippopotamus and Leviathan the crocodile of the Nile River. Maybe they were ancient dinosaurs. Maybe Behemoth is the beast and Leviathan the dragon of Revelation. I don't know. I don't think anybody really knows. The explanation that I guess I prefer is where these animals are called chaos creatures. They're part of God's creation when he made the universe, and they're uncontrollable except by God himself. So God's answer is basically just a whole lot of questions. Perhaps we should not be surprised that Jesus often did the same. Rather than answering questions, Jesus often asked another question. And that would be something to keep in mind for the final message on Job, where we'll look at how to respond to suffering. I had to put this quote in. George Bernard Shaw says this of God's response to Job: "If I complain that I am suffering unjustly, it's no answer to say, 'Can you make a hippopotamus?'" Now that's true, quite so. Shaw misses the point though. God is saying, "Hey Job, I run the cosmos. I made it. I make it work. Not only do I know these things, but I can do these things. And you need to trust in my wisdom and my power, because I know what I'm doing." So he's kind of answered Job by asking a whole lot of questions. So Job humbles himself in his brief reply to God. Chapter 42. "I'm convinced you can do anything and everything. Nothing and no one can upset your plans. You asked, 'Who's muddying the water?' Ignorantly confusing the issue, second-guessing my purposes. I admit it, I was the one. I babbled on about things far beyond me, made small talk about wonders way over my head." So that's the last thing Job said. So, I'm just going to bring it all together now. I want to go back and look at the retribution principle and try and put it to bed, so to speak. It's a bit like this, I think. God is saying, "You guys made up the retribution principle to explain how the world works. I never said it was true. Yet you want me to behave according to this idea that you've made up yourselves. It's not going to work. So, here we go. See, on the one hand, the retribution principle is true. God does delight in blessing the righteous, and he does punish the wicked. Yet on the other hand, it's not true. God does not always punish the wicked, as Job is at pains to point out to his friends. So here's a statement. Smoking causes lung cancer. Is that true? Always? No? My grandfather started smoking at the age of 15 and smoked till he was 65, stopped, lived another 21 years. So smoking does cause lung cancer, but it didn't for my grandfather. And so, yeah, not always. How about this? A proverb that we all know. Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he's old, he will not depart from it. Is that true? Yeah, sometimes. It's good advice. See, that's why it's a proverb, not a rule. It's a principle, not a promise. It's often true, but it's not an absolute statement that is always true. Just like the lung cancer statement. And that's how it works for the retribution principle. It's a principle, not a promise. So, God does bless the righteous, and he does punish the wicked. But you don't have to be a rocket scientist to see that that doesn't always happen. And if the retribution is not always true, then you can never invoke the corollary and say that if bad things happen to you, that's because you've done bad things. That is a rabbit hole you do not want to go down. Never use the retribution principle as a convenient explanation of suffering. We just don't know what's going on in that regard. However, the good news is that God does know. God knows, and because God is wise, we can trust him. So my summary of God's speech to Job and his friends would be this. Trust me. Trust me. I made the cosmos. I run. I know what I'm doing. Right, so that brings us to the epilogue. The poetry is over, and a little bit of prose to finish off. So I'll read the entire epilogue because it's wonderfully short. After God had finished addressing Job, he turned to Eliphaz the Temanite and said, "I've had it with you and your two friends. I'm fed up. You haven't been honest either with me or about me, not the way my friend Job has. So here's what you must do. Take 7 bulls and 7 rams and go to my friend Job. Sacrifice a burnt offering on your own behalf. Friend Job will pray for you and I will accept his prayer. He will ask me not to treat you as you deserve for talking about me and for not being honest with me as he has." So they did it. Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, Zophar the Naamathite did what God commanded, and God accepted Job's prayer. After Job had interceded for his friends, God restored his fortune and then doubled it. All his brothers and sisters and friends came to his house and celebrated. They told him how sorry they were and consoled him for all the trouble God had brought him. Each of them brought generous housewarming gifts. God blessed Job's later life even more than his earlier life. He ended up with 14,000 sheep, 6,000 camels, 1,000 teams of oxen, and 1,000 donkeys. He also had 7 sons and 3 daughters. He named the first daughter Jemima, the second Kezia, and the third Keren-Hapuktha. There was not a woman in that country as beautiful as Job's daughters. Their father treated them as equals with their brothers, providing them the same inheritance. Unheard of in those days to do that. Job lived on another 140 years, living to see his children and grandchildren, four generations of them. And then he died, an old man full of life. Okay. Job has been restored. His fortunes have been restored. He has his family again. His wealth and dignity have returned. A happy ending. Well, yes and no, really. Job is certainly comfortable, but is he comforted? What about the pain of his dead children and grandchildren, all who remain dead? They didn't come back to life. Job has no idea why this happened to him. There's been no explanation, so he'll go through the rest of his life not knowing why it happened. God has not explained it. So I'd say that Job's suffering has been taken away and his suffering remains. It's kind of, yeah, comme ci, comme ça. In the final message on Job in a couple of weeks' time, God willing, we're going to look deeper into the topic of suffering. And so I thought I'd finish with a question, something that you could think about for the next couple of weeks before we tackle it. What can we learn from the book of Job about suffering? Yeah, I mean, up to you to ponder that. So, as we would say in Myanmar, pibabi, which means I'm done. That's the end. Let's pray. Lord, it's a very unusual book of the Bible. Unwilling to be bent into a nice, convenient explanation of things that would make us probably feel a lot more comfortable. It shows us part of you that almost makes us annoyed or angry. And were it not for the fact that the scriptures teach us that you are a good God, I think we'd have right to be angry, but we know that you're good. And whether or not we have explanations, we can still trust you. So may we continue to learn from the wise words that are contained in the book of Job. Thank you for the opportunity to look into it and help us to think through that question on suffering for the final message in a couple of weeks. So I think I should finish. I think this is it. So, and there's no pastor here to finish. So you've got, sorry. I have finished.